This is Barbara Peters. I'm talking to James McGrath. Jamie to me here today.
Well, it's James McGrath Morris.
But James McGrath Morris, thank you, who is writing, in fact, a biography of Tony Hillerman, who is one of my most loved and always one of our best-selling authors at the Poison Pen. So if we were going to talk about Tony's career, The Blessing Way, which was his first novel, was published, we think, in the early 70s?
Yeah, early 70s, 70, 71, somewhere around
okay.
there.
Okay, and as we've just been talking about, what happened was he took, in the 70s, was an era of very much male private eye and police procedural, so forth, in crime fiction. Bob Parker wrote his first Spencer, I think, in 1975. Ed McBain was probably writing the 80s. I'm just guessing here because I haven't looked all this up.
Yeah, don't
maybe
look up
the
our
87th
dates.
Precinct. Well, it's just kind yep. of a gut feeling. Ross McDonald had been writing the Lou Archer books, you know, that kind of thing. And so Tony came along and he took this form, gave it a different landscape, New Mexico, gave his detective a different ethnicity. Mm-hmm. But are you suggesting to me that maybe Leghorn was not... What do you think the genesis of The Blessing Way was?
At this point, a year into researching his life, I think in many ways, his first novel that led to the 18 novels was an accident. Much like an artist who's doing something on a canvas and some paint drips down and everybody likes the way it drips. He was writing a classic mystery because he wanted to write a great American novel, and he thought mystery would be a way to warm up for that.
Right.
And in doing so, if you remember, the main character is really an archaeologist, and the Leghorn is introduced into the book, but the attention doesn't center on him. And he writes that book. It's the famously Ann Elmo, who represented him, the agent, who had represented his nonfiction for the last 4 or 5 years, told him the book was okay, but you might want to get rid of this Indian stuff.
Yes.
And Joan Kahn, luckily at HarperCollins, said, no, keep it, and published it. Hillerman's next novel was not a continuation of this, but in fact was a political mystery set in mostly in Oklahoma, although partly modeled on some other state capitals, called The Fly on the Wall.
Right.
That didn't do very well, and I think at that moment he thought, well, what have I got going for myself? And he realized he had, in a sense, invented a new concept, or this idea of moving the classic detective novel to a different, as you said, landscape and culture. And it's on his third novel, the second in the Navajo series, that I think he realized what he had created. I don't think he realized it in the first one.
And that was The Dark One?
Yeah.
And was that the one that moved towards the Zuni Reservation?
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure you're putting me on the spot. But
no,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure it is too. And in fact, I'm wearing my Zuni bracelet
I'm
here.
I'm wearing a Navajo bracelet I bought in Zuni land. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, the Zuni turquoise is differentiated yes. by this kind of needlepoint right. effect right. here we have, whereas, you know, this.
Yeah.
I reread it not too long ago, and the Zuni Reservation is within the Navajo, right?
Yeah. It's just south of it, yes.
Right, so, but it's in New Mexico.
Correct, right near Gallup.
So it wasn't a big stretch for Tony to, he lived in
Santa Fe. The big thing for Tony is that he's very fortunate that he chose Navajos, because the Pueblo, had he set these in Pueblos, he would have had a very hard time. Pueblos are extraordinarily closed societies. In a way, the Navajo is almost like Unitarians in comparison to Pueblo society and how open they are. Now, they did want to keep a lot of certain things private, but they were much more open to an Anglo like Hillerman wandering around and asking questions. That would have led to a lot of problems. So if you notice, the Pueblos that show up in his books are often from the viewpoint of Chi or Leghorn, not from the viewpoint of a Zuni member.
That's very astute. No, I hadn't really thought about that. I know that the Hopi, where he says sacred clans, is a reservation within.
It's encircled by the Navajos.
The Navajo reservation, and there are lots of. I mean, the Navajo are not just one state or the other. It's New Mexico and Arizona, so it's a very large territory. Although Leghorn and Chi are really based in New Mexico.
They are.
Nonetheless, they can wander over. Anne has wandered over to Monument Valley, for example, for one of her books, which I thought was fascinating, going up to Goulding.
Well, as you know, one of Hillerman's novels ends up going to Washington, D.C., so it does move around.
Yes.
Sometimes. The key for me, and part of my purposeful vagueness in recounting the novels, is I read them as a reader. My job now is to recreate the creation of these books. So I'm preparing myself to read them in an entirely different way, and I'm postponing that until I finish getting his life up to the 60s. So I've been researching World War II, his childhood in Oklahoma, his job as a journalist in Borger, Texas, Lawson, Oklahoma, and arriving in New Mexico, and the courage of leaving with adopted children and a household, leaving his good job at the Santa Fe New Mexican to take the plunge to go to the University of New Mexico and get a degree in writing in midlife and recast himself. So as a biographer, you want to go along with the ride and you want to be reintroduced to the works in a way, in a fresh way. So I purposely don't open up his novels right now. I won't until September. I try to do everything possible not to think about them, because I need to look at them in a contemporaneous fashion and see things. And he left a wonderful breadcrumb. I mean, I'll be able to reconstruct why certain things occurred, where he got the information from. His records are immense. So in a way, I can undo the mystery behind the creation of these books. And I think it's important, because my pitch to my publisher and my pitch to the world is that Hillerman didn't just write compelling mysteries. He used the genre of mysteries to introduce Navajos to the world. And that's why the French know about Navajos. That's why the Germans know about Navajos. I had dinner with a trained anthropologist in Washington, D.C., and she told me something about Navajos. And I was expecting, when I challenged her, where did you learn this from, for her to cite some scholarly article. And she leaned back in her chair and said, from Hillerman, of course.
Well, he inspired other authors, too. If you recall, James Doss wrote some wonderful books about the Utes. Margaret Cole has just, I think, signed off, although I'm hoping not, on her wonderful book about the Arapaho and the Wind River Reservation. I've always thought it was interesting that that there are no actual Indians writing about. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because the detective novel is really an Anglo form of fiction.
I think that's the reason, because American Indians have moved into literature in a great way. I mean, there are a number of incredible works, both poetic and fiction. But I think the concept of the detective novel is such an Anglo thing that it's not ill-suited, but it wouldn't necessarily be something that a Native American would be led to write or want to write in. And the other avenues have been so much more open in the last 20 years for them.
Yes, I've actually hosted some Native American writers of fiction, and that's been our discussion, and I think it's true. I also think that Tony, because of his career in journalism, had an opportunity to come up with, to craft plots and so forth that were suitable for the detective novel based upon real life things that happened.
When we were mentioning his first novel, when he wrote his first novel, he reached into his mental notes or paper notes back to Borger, Texas, and Leaphorn has a lot of the characters of the sheriff that was in the town when Tony was covering crime in Borger, Texas after World War II.
Wow. Well, I was thinking, too, you know, there were some real stories, like, I haven't reread them for a long time, but the one that's set in the Grand Canyon.
With the airplane crash.
Yes, took his genesis exactly from that. And a number of his later books, the line, I think, between journalism and fiction became much more blurred. And you said to me earlier today that you also think that his life is, you know, mm-hmm. his own life and his fiction and his reporting all
and
converged.
I think that's common. My previous book was about John Dos Passos and Ernest Hemingway, and I found the more they got away from their nonfiction, the more they wrote fiction, the less scrupulous. And maybe scrupulous is wrong, because it sounds like they committed a crime, but the fuzziness became that you, using plot devices and things like that, sometimes what you were recounting wasn't necessarily corresponding to the facts.
Well, crime fiction isn't your native habitat, but it is mine. And I can tell you that that's one of the joys of crime fiction, is mm-hmm. that it is a very expansive, very generous genre. We used to call it mystery, and now I call it crime fiction, because mystery was too small. And it's constantly changing, mutating, whatever, but there are a tremendous number of authors who are inspired. I bet people that when the river flooded, I said to everybody, Sarah Paresky's next book is going to take this event into account. And sure enough, it did. I'd have to look up the title. But, I mean, you know, it was a major event in the city that she writes about.
Hillerman does this all the time. His files are filled with newspaper clippings that he uses. And you mentioned generosity. He often rewards friends and sources by putting them into the book themselves by name. And he really reached out. There's a wonderful man, Robert Rosebrough in Gallup, who was once mayor of Gallup, who helped Tony understand about rock climbing and all the details. And Tony was such a lovable man that people were more than glad to provide him with the real stuff that made his novels the verisimilitude that really made you feel like you were there.
Well, he also used real places. Yeah. For example, is it in The Blessing Way where we are in the trading post? Mm-hmm. I think it is. And I've been to the Hubble Trading Post as just an example. I think many people have been to the Hubble Trading Post, whether Hillerman fans or not. But in fact, I mentioned to you the new Hillerman Indian Country map and guide from Time Traveler Maps in Colorado. I think the original one came out in the 90s. We sold hundreds of them to people who would buy them and then use them to plot trips around Arizona and New Mexico, specifically to sites that Tony had put in his books. So they felt real, because even though they were fiction, because they were anchored in real places.
But they were real, and also it got him into some trouble, because occasionally he would move places, and he'd move because he needed a 20-minute drive or something, and he would get endless letters. You must know, Mr. Hillerman, that this town is not located 20 miles north of Ganado. It's actually 10 miles south. Or, this reservation doesn't border on that spot. I mean, these readers would really write, and very politely sometimes, sometimes not. And I could just tell Hillerman, sort of pulling in his collar and saying, "Well, this is a novel. I needed it for plot reasons." But you're right, you really feel like you're there.
You do.
Sense of place and geography is so important in his books.
And in fact, I have heard over the last three decades endless stories from writers, no matter where you put your book, if it's in Los Angeles or Phoenix or, Paris, people will tell you how much Dan Brown got wrong in The Da Vinci Code about Paris and so forth. So that's an inherent danger in using any real place. But if you make one up, then that's a whole different set of problems.
It is. But it might be the easier solution.
Well,
sometimes.
Not really. And I think for Tony, he was really introducing a culture that, when I first came to Phoenix, Indian School Road was called Indian School Road for a reason.
Yeah.
And now we're all probably going to airbrush that out about, tragic time when, we thought we would just take those children out of their culture and teach them differently. And Tony was really one of the first people, I think, to reach a predominantly white European audience in a way to present a native, although Tony always said they just want to be called Indians. So, I'm always hesitant today whether I should say Native American or Indian, but I think we're talking about Tony, I'll just say Indian. In bringing, Indian culture to a group of people who hadn't given it much serious consideration, and doing it in a way that was respectful and affectionate even, and I think created in his readers that same response. It certainly did in me.
It's interesting you say that. An LA Times editor wrote me recently, we were corresponding about Hillerman. He said that Hillerman, like Raymond Chandler, who made LA a mental map that we carry with us, that Hillerman made Navajo land a mental map that we always will carry with us, that it retains.
That's absolutely true. I've had that conversation with Michael Connelly over the years. And whenever I think of Michael and Raymond Chandler, the first line that comes to my head always is, "The jacaranda trees are in bloom again," which is kind of a signature line that Michael has commented on it. You do, Spencer's Boston. There are authors who truly make a place so real for readers that, we're the Outlander bookstore. So I've been fascinated to see how many people are now going on tours of Scotland inspired by Diana's work. And that was true when The Da Vinci Code was at its peak. People were taking tours around France,
It won't be long before some tourist organization will be commissioning mysteries to bring people to their locales.
Well, we are initially publishing at Poison Pan Press a series of Italian mysteries by a former Foreign Service officer. He was touring people around Italy in a way, a different way than Donna Leon is doing about Venice or Michael Dibden did years ago. But we wander. Anyway, my point was that I think that Tony, at the time he started, there was virtually nothing known nor very little interest in what he was writing about, and points to him and to HarperCollins that they pursued it. And gradually, you know, his was not an overnight success story. It wasn't like The Blessing Way had a very small initial print run. Those books took a very long curve.
Took a decade before they really began to catch.
They did. And he became an icon and a much loved figure. And I've always been grateful that he lived a long life despite his war wounds and so forth. Long enough to write Seldom Disappointed, which I think is one of my favorite memoirs.
It's a great memoir.
It's a beautiful book. Yeah. When I did an event with him for it, people cried. I could watch them in the audience, you know, because I had to stand alongside him. He was so deaf by then, he couldn't interact with the audience without help. And I've always been grateful that he was able to do that. And I think that Tony's fans really ought to read Seldom Disappointed, which you have, even though you're waiting to read the mystery.
Well, I'm
reading
I've been reading it over and over and over and over again because I look for clues.
How do you expect your book as a biography to be different than Seldom Disappointed, which is a memoir, isn't it?
Well, I think a lot of ways will be different. A memoir is really a recollection from memory of life, and I'm Tony's assistant here. I mean, he's in the wrong towns in France when he's fighting because it's been 50 years since he was fighting, or 40 some years. So I use a lot more of records to reconstruct the fight. I have a bird's eye view of where he was and what he was doing. For him, it's just another nameless French town I can explain as part of the larger things and the battles that took place. Secondly, there's a lot of interpretation. What were the key elements that shaped him? He hints at them in there. I mean, obviously his mother going to school with Potawatomi children in Sacred Heart. But that sense of us and them that he develops early on, the effect of the GI Bill, he kind of brushes off. I mean, he says it's important. So you'll get an independent view of his life. And also what I hope to do is capture him in the moment of creativity to show how the books were written. He leaves a lot of clues and a lot of explanations, but I will be reconstructing the writing because I have every man in his collection. I have every iteration of the manuscripts. I can see how they change and how they develop and what goes on. So I think if you like Hillerman, the backstory of his life will be immensely enhancing to anybody's love of Hillerman's books.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it. And I hear you saying you're doing a combination of fact-checking and interpretation.
Very much so. You always have to do that. I mean, this is not my first. This is my fifth, at least, biography. And I was trained as a journalist like Tony was. And the first thing any of your editors tell you is your mother says she loves you. Check it out. And Hillerman, as a journalist, was always very skeptical and did that kind of checking out. And it enhances the story. A memoir, you know, is not written like an autobiography. An autobiography usually requires a lot of fact-checking, going back to find your diaries, making sure you had lunch with that person on a particular day. Biographer's view is much more like a portrait painting, where I have to go and find all this material to enhance it, to explain it, to put it in context. When Tony describes writing his first novels, he doesn't tell you about the state of literature at that point and what mysteries are being published and what the world was reading. And he also has some odd, very understandable recollections. He believes he read Upfield as a child. Well, it turns out Upfield's works were not published in the States when he was a child. It was more likely he took them out of UNM library when he was a writing student. It's not to show that he was wrong, but it's to give a more accurate story of his life in a way that I think enhances his achievement, not diminishes it.
So do you feel that Seldom Disappointed, that it could have been better fact-checked by the publisher?
Well, my argument is that I think it's an insult to him. HarperCollins had made a fortune off this man, and when he showed up with his memoir, which was a moving, compelling book, they didn't give it the attention they would have given his fiction. There are basic copy editing mistakes in there. that take place. He gets on the bus with Huckins, a man who will become, this is when he's a recruit going to World War II, and he's recounting that, and the town name that Huckins came from is misspelled, and it's the kind of thing you just don't have happen. It's not Tony's job to have done that, particularly at that age in a memoir. He recounts going to a concert with Fats Domino. Fats Domino wasn't performing for 13 years. He has the wrong date for a number of battle events. All things that anybody, any basic copy editor would have done. So I think it says more about the attitude of major corporate publishing at that point than it does about Tony's quality of his work, because I've been writing nonfiction for years, and we love and depend on our editors to catch these things. I had a book that had two streets that are parallel in Chicago crossing. Luckily, somebody caught it before the book went to press, because you know what would happen is I'd have gotten 100 letters from Chicago and saying, those two streets don't cross. Publishing is a cooperative venture between an author and an editor, and the editor in this case let him down.
I asked you that question, not as a slam on HarperCollins, but rather to say that I think your biography perhaps is more important in that sense, that, you know, it's going to correct a lot of things that might have been confusing or inaccurate in Tony's memoir, which he wrote late in life when, you know, he had hearing problems and potentially memory problems. And
look, one of the things that's interesting about the memoir is how many pages are devoted to World War II. Like many World War II veterans, he didn't speak about his war experience for a long time, and it's almost like presented with the idea of a memoir, he just poured it out. And so my objection is not as much to find fault with HarperCollins, but it has a lot to do with the state of publishing at that point, fears about, the, you know, what, are e-books going to wipe us out, and is Amazon going to cut our profits, that I think it reflects more on the state of publishing rather than any one particular editor at HarperCollins. But I think it's sad because it's such a good memoir that to have led it, to have treated it that way is disrespectful to Tony.
Well, in some senses, I suppose you could say it's closer to his fiction than nonfiction, although, you know, he did rely on his memory. Anyway, I think, you know, I certainly will want to read your biography for a grounding, a regrounding in Tony's life. And I'm going to reread Seldom Disappointed, I think, alongside it, because it remains one of my absolute favorite
books. It's a wonderful book, and it's one of the many things that attracted me to him. And just keep in mind that biographies are like the never-ending pregnancy. This book will take a number of years to get out there.
Very likely so. Well, we're talking on April 2nd, 2018. Do you have any idea when
It's supposed to come out in 2020.
2020. So it really
probably
is a long... And you've already been working on it.
Yeah.
So it's at least a three-year commitment
or longer.
It can be.
I've had a book, the book I wrote on Joseph Pulitzer that established me, took five years full-time work. Well, I mean, I've been to, you know, the National Archives to pull his military record. I'm here in Scottsdale to interview you. I'm going back to... I've spent time wandering the streets. Well, not even streets, the dirt roads of Sacred Heart where he grew up, seeing what's left of his house, been to his high school, been to the monastery where he worked. I mean, it takes a long time to do these things.
It really does. And I have directed you to the Library of Congress video where I interviewed Tony at the National Book Festival, which, if I recall, we spent a fair amount of time talking about Seldom Disappointed. So
right. Well,
it
I'll
might
be
if you listen to it, because I think the library keeps those up forever, although it may be at this point hard to find. So my other favorite thing about that, to conclude this, is when Tony and I went, it was the year of the Washington shooters. This was on the Mall, you know. Very public spot. Huge crowds. I mean, he had a huge crowd, thousands of people in this tent and so forth. And I still remember Tony looking at me just before we walked out on stage, and he said, "Remind me," he said, "why are we doing this?" And I said to him, "We are probably the safest two people in Washington, because you can see this mass of security, you know, way out on the fringes and so forth." But, you know, that was Tony. He had a wonderful sense of humor. You know, he did. It was very, very quiet, but very, very wry, and yet right to the point.
On a final note, one of the great pleasures of writing his life is he's just one of the nicest, most generous, most caring individuals. There'll be no horror stories in this book.
And I'd like to say, although I only knew Marie, his wife, slightly, that his daughter Anne has become a very good friend. We are, in fact, here today in part to launch her fourth book in which she has brought Bernie Manuelita into the Lee Porininchi. And so this will be, I think, a wonderful legacy for Tony to have her continue these characters.
Oh, I think he'd be thrilled.
And also, I'm sure he would be, but she's also taking them to places deliberately that he didn't go. This new one will be the Malpais, which we drove in December on our way to New Mexico to check out. She's been up to Monument Valley. She's been over to Chaco. And so I think she's within the actual physical universe of Tony's book. She is exploring new assets, new aspects of it, which I think he would absolutely have loved. Thank you for talking to me.
You're welcome. Thank you.